That sun is sending out a very strong signal across a lot of frequencies to hit the Earth, hit your objects. The objects give you some absorption, re-radiation, you and I call it reflection, and some of that comes into the eye. All of those optical signals from that sun, from that piece of gold in your backyard that's reflecting in that eye responding, it is a radio signal. It just happens to be at a higher frequency. Here we are way down at 146 megacycles, and we think that's a pretty high frequency compared to 80 meters at 3.5 megacycles. They're all the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. And to figure out what light is, we all have a gut feel of what 2 meters is and 450, 70 centimeters. We've got a gut feel for that. Go a little bit higher than that, I go to 600 megahertz. I got a gut feel for what is 600 megahertz radio signal. Take that frequency of 600 megahertz, multiply it by a million, and you and I call that new higher radio frequency, optical frequency, we call it yellow-green. That's what the eye would see. The exact same stuff, just higher in frequency. Let me drop. And now, as I start going from red toward ultraviolet, because of Planck's law, I think it is, energy equals H nu, in other words, as you go to higher frequencies, each individual minor particle, called a photon, of the light, has higher and higher energy when you go to higher frequency. That's just a basic law of physics. When you get to the ultraviolet and beyond, the amount of energy per photon is high enough that it's called ionizing. Ionizing means when that higher frequency energy hits your eye, hits your lens, hits your retina, hits your cornea, it's capable of creating cellular damage. The higher the frequencies in violet, ultraviolet, and far ultraviolet, and into X-rays, get higher and higher energy, and they're capable of doing cellular disruption. They're capable of changing the DNA and doing cellular damage. So therefore, if you're a real smart guy, let me drop, and you're doing a lot of radio control airplane modeling work, sort of, and you're flying your airplane, and you're looking up into the sky a lot, you better be wearing dark glasses that filter out the ultraviolet. If you don't, some number of years downrange of you staring up into the sky, where you do a whole lot of beach work without sunglasses, and a whole lot of lying in the sun, so to speak, without eye protection, as you get into the older age and you start getting cataracts and whatever, because of ultraviolet exposure, you're going to pay the price. You can set that hi-fi in your automobile as loud as you like. You're going to create hearing damage. In your older years, you're going to recognize that. You look into the sky with a lot of ultraviolet energy, at high noon, so to speak, without eye protection. You're going to be creating eye damage because of what's called, ionizing radiation. The higher frequencies, the shorter wavelengths, have more energy and they're capable of doing damage. Treat it with respect or you're going to pay the price downrange. On that happy note, I turn it over to Dennis, NY2HF, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Nick. Just two questions. Because I was an avid diver. When you go down 33.3 feet under the surface of the water, it's an additional atmosphere. And each 33 and a third feet that you go, it's another atmosphere. So you have the atmosphere when you're standing on Earth is 14 miles or something tall, and that's one atmosphere. Why would you breathe the same amount of air or oxygen in a space station that's weightless, has no gravity, has no pressure, unless it's a pressurized space station, or is one exclusive of the other? I just wondered, wouldn't you be actually breathing less? Because when you're diving, the deeper you go, the more pressure is on your oxygen supply, and the faster you consume it, at greater depth. Back to that.
Yeah, there's a lot of complicated things going on this one, as I see it, Dennis. The astronaut, in order for his blood not to be boiling, in other words, if I take a bottle of water and I connect a vacuum pump to the top of the bottle and I start going to a low enough air pressure, the water will boil. In other words, water at room temperature has a certain vapor pressure at the surface, and if I go below that pressure in the air above the water will boil. You can boil water all the way down to the freezing temperature, 1 degree above an ice cube temperature. You can put a hard enough vacuum there and it will boil. And you don't want your blood, the water in your blood to be boiling. Therefore, the space station, by definition, is pressurized. The atmosphere produces a pressure for you automatically because there's, as you said, 14 miles of air above you pulling down on gravity, the gravity pulling down on it, and it creates a pressure. In the space station, you create the pressure not by way of a 14-mile-high chunk of air, by way of a sealed container, and you've pressurized that container. You've opened up the valve on this pressurized cylinder of air or oxygen, and you've released it into that International Space Station chamber, and you've created that pressure artificially. And it's got to be there, otherwise you're not going to be alive. Now, your body, in order to create metabolism, requires a certain amount of real oxygen per breath, per second, per minute, flowing into your lungs, going into your blood, and carrying on the metabolism. A certain amount of oxygen is required. In theory, when you go down to a deeper depth, you would think that because of the higher pressure of the air that must be supplied to your lungs for you to be breathing correctly, let me drop. You would think you could breathe more slowly, because now the air being compressed at the greater depth is a higher concentration of both air molecules and oxygen molecules. You think you could breathe a smaller number of cubic feet per minute. Well, you'd think so. Does the lung at the higher pressure operate at the same efficiency is another question. How efficient is the lung to suck out the oxygen in that compressed air? And by the way, as you go down deep enough, the lung loses the ability to do differentiation. The lung wants to absorb the oxygen and ignore everything else. You go to a high enough pressure, the lung loses the differentiation and starts absorbing the nitrogen also. And once that nitrogen gets into your bloodstream and gets into your joints, if you come up too rapidly before you get a chance to dissipate it, you get the bends, you get some real damage. So you lose differentiation capability, you lose efficiency as you go down to greater depths. So the same amount of oxygen must be getting into your bloodstream per second. Let me drop. Because you are a 130-watt transmitter. Every minute, every second, every hour of every day, the metabolism of your body is a 130-watt generator. You are burning oxygen and fuel and water to the rate that you are generating 130 watts of heat continuously. Your body must do that to maintain your body at 98 and a fraction degrees Fahrenheit. You go a couple of degrees below that. Your muscles don't work right. Your brain doesn't work right. You go into all kinds of difficulties. The body must be continuously creating 130 watts of metabolism, of burning of oxygen. With all the efficiencies and inefficiencies of the particular environment you're in, you've got to be doing that or you're not alive. I know that's some of the answer from my point of view, Dennis. NYQHF, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Thank you, Nick. One other component of that, and you're exactly right, one other component of that whole discussion was that oxygen actually becomes toxic and lethal at about 220 to 240 feet. And that's why when deep divers go down, they actually use less oxygen and they use an inert gas as a way of being able to go down to the depths that they do. Back to that.
N2LDY?
N2LDY, go right ahead.
You know what would be a good topic for discussion on a future net? Would be the life support system that they use on the International Space Station, you know?
WS2N?
Interesting to hear about.
And WS2N?
Yeah, that's a rather elaborate system. That Paul probably has been studying that, WS2N. He can give us some information on that when at dawn. Yeah, the way the human body behaves under high pressure and low pressure. You take the guy who's climbing to the top of Mount Everest, and he goes above, I guess it's something like 25,000 feet, which is called the death zone. The air pressure is so darn low, even with proper training, you are burning up brain molecules permanently. You are creating damage depending on how long you dwell above the 25,000 foot when you're climbing Mount Everest. You're making a hell of a sacrifice to do that. And is it worth it? It's a darn interesting question. You go down to these deep depths where the lung starts behaving differently, and you start absorbing other gases. And ordinary oxygen with that particular mixture becomes lethal unless you put other inert gases in there. So recognizing the metabolism characteristic of the human body, roughly 130 watts of continuous dissipation, 450 BTUs per hour, a whole audience sitting in that theater, every one of those people just sitting there are burning up 450 BTU per hour of heat. And if you don't have an air conditioning system capable of handling that, that theater is going to get awful hot. And my brother just loves baseball, and he has a friend with a season ticket to Yankee Stadium. And I'm sitting there at Yankee Stadium watching a game. My brother is very disappointed because I'm watching the bird that flew over Yankee Stadium. And I watched the bird try to fly across the top of the stadium, and he had a very sudden rise. And I calculated the 30,000 people sitting in that stadium, how much heat they were generating. And they were generating a huge thermal above that stadium, and the bird trying to fly across hit that thermal, and he said, probably said to myself, what the hell is going on down there? What's making all that heat? Let me drop. And that heat is all those people are generating all of that heat, and we keep completely forget about that. Paul, tell us about how the astronauts maintain that air on the International Space Station. And my goodness, are we out of schedule as usual. WS2N with the space report, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul. And by the way, at the end, give us a couple more words on the latest with Voyager. I'm so amazed at what that piece of electronics can do. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N. Name is Paul, and as far as the, I want to cover a couple of topics, but the air inside the space station is 14.7. It actually keeps the same as what is here. It actually got the same mixture. It has nitrogen, oxygen. They have nitrogen tanks on it. They've got extra tanks on board, huge tanks that are attached to the outside of the Quest module. Nitrogen tanks, oxygen tanks. They do have a recycling system going on one step beyond the scrubbers that you mentioned, the lithium hydroxide scrubbers. They now take, not all of it, they like to do all of it, but they take that and they separate it, and that's being done. They brought up a unit in the one of the nodes, the Tranquility node has that, and that's the one with the cupola attached to it. And they've got a lot of chemistry going on there, trying to separate the oxygen from the carbon dioxide that everybody's breathing out. So there's some recycling going on. It's not 100%. Let them get 100%, and then you can be a little bit more comfortable maybe going to Mars. Let me drop it. We've covered that many times on the net, and we'll do it again. Relationship between the oxygen, when they do the spacewalks, yeah, that's all pure oxygen, but they're down to 3 pounds per square inch, but they need that pure oxygen. Like you said before, the human body needs a certain amount of oxygen to sustain itself, and at 14.7 pounds, it's okay to have the, whatever it is, the probably one-third oxygen. Compared to the two-thirds nitrogen, but when you get down to 3 pounds, that ain't going to work, so they need that. And then we can get into the Quest module and what they can go through to camping out procedure before the EVAs. We've done all that, but we'll do it again, Dick. As far as the NASA, what's new with NASA, well, if you look at any of the NASA websites, there you are. they shut all their servers down. I mean, there is no information coming out of the NASA site. 99.9% of it is off. You go to NASA.gov, you'll see a statement talking about the government shutdown. Well, we don't shut down on ham radio, so we can continue on, and we'll continue on with the space program information as well. It's been down for, what, almost 7 days. You know, there's information out there on other websites, there's magazines, there's some critical, somewhat critical missions that are going on. One is the LADEE program. We talked about that on the net when it took off on a Friday night. Some people actually got to see it take off from Wallops Island, Virginia. And that successfully went out and did three orbits around the Earth. When I talk about orbits, it goes out, you know, 20, 30, 50,000. The last one was like 100,000-mile orbit, 13 days to make one orbit around the Earth. So it finally had gotten to the point where it was about to go in front of the moon, and the moon's gravity was going to... And... of course, government shut down. NASA continuing on to do this. They didn't, you know, those employees are still working. The two skeleton crew people out, that are out there, that's one of the things that they're doing. But the reporting end of it is not, it's not there. It's not, the information's not getting out. So, I went to countless websites. Finally found one on Universe. It's a Universe website. Actually comes out of, I think it comes out of Europe, universetoday.com, and they did, as far as the beginning of the net, they made the statement that fire its main engine this morning at 6:57 a.m. and successfully achieved lunar orbit, and that is the headline for that. With that spacecraft, nobody else was reporting it. People apparently looked for the information, and then they were quoting what NASA was saying, that they're not going to release the information. Somehow these people found out about it. It's a reputable site. I have University Today saved the favorites. They're pretty good, so I could be reasonably sure that they did succeed in doing that. There are some other missions that that NASA is still continuing on with, certain critical ones. There are critical phase. They wanted to cut off the MAVEN program. That's the one, next one that was going to Mars. And that's the one that's going to be in orbit around Mars, checking the atmosphere. I mean, taking low loops into the atmosphere and really looking into the science behind that. But the MAVEN, or the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution spacecraft, is continuing its schedule. They realize that it has a certain launch window coming up November 18th. They plan on launching MAVEN this year. Without that, they would have to wait another year or so, and then they would have had to actually probably about a year and a half, and then they would have had to actually use a lot more fuel to get it there. So they're continuing on with the eventual MAVEN launch. Another topic, I know it's late, but I had to talk about the Juno spacecraft. Juno is the one that's on the way to Jupiter. It was launched about 2.5 years ago. They consider it halfway through its mission. But the 9th, this Wednesday, it's coming very close to Earth. It's on what they call a gravity assist. Now, it's been out already way past Mars, and now it's on the way back. It's just going to pass Earth on Wednesday. It's going to come very close, like maybe 20,000, 30,000 miles above the Earth, and it will get the boost from the Earth's orbit around the Sun to give it that final push toward Jupiter. Well, in doing so, they want to test one of the pieces of equipment on board. There's about 10 different scientific detecting gadgets on board Juno. And one of them is called the wave machine, the wave detector. It's basically a radio and plasma type detector. And they plan on using amateur radio. Anybody who's around at 1800 Zulu on Wednesday has the ability to transmit on 20 meters, they would actually like the people to say, send the word hi in CW to the spacecraft. And the engineers are going to try to copy this and make sure everything's going okay. But to do it, it has to be done slow. This is the slowest CW you'll ever hear. And the only thing that's going to be fast about it would be if you send your calls in the beginning and the end for identification. What they're going to do is in this 10-minute segment, this is going to go on for 2 hours and 40 minutes, but every 10 minutes, starting at 1800 Zulu, which is 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern Standard Time, so you don't have to figure it out if you're sitting there thinking about it. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so a lot of retired people or sick people might be able to do this on Wednesday unless you got a ham radio at work. And you'd be able to transmit CW the first 30 seconds, you key it down. The next 30 seconds, you unkey and let it just sit there. And then key it down again, 30 seconds. It's the world, like I said, the world's slowest CW. So after you're doing this over and over again, you'll eventually get the letter H. Each time you push it down, it was a dot. And each time you release it, it's the space. And then eventually you're going to get to the end of that, and there'll be 3 spaces. And then another dot, and another dot.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This whole time segment of 10 minutes is one group, and then you can do it again. I mean, the end result of this is you're going to have collective hams transmitting all at the same time. And because it's on 10 meters, it should bounce around in the ionosphere. So it doesn't have to be directly overhead. You don't need a beam. Dipole is fine. 100 watts is great if you got it. Now, how are they going to time everything? How is everybody going to push the button at the same time? Well, there's a website that you can go to. Actually, there's 2 of them. NASA kept theirs open. But the only problem is the only thing that's left on there is the timer and this key down system and release system. The information is gone, but I do have one other website that's not a NASA site that has all this information. It also has the timer. So there's a countdown going now. If you go on to it, it says 2 days and how many hours, how many seconds, whatever it is. And then when it gets down to 0, this one square is going to light up, and that means to push it down for one dot, and then another one is going to release, is going to tell you when to release the key. It's going to go on and on, and you could, you know, if you could do it for 10 minutes, that's good. If you do it for 20 minutes, that's good. Some people might be fanatics and go 2.5 hours. If you do it, you could go to, there's an email that I'll give out, that you can get your QSL card from to show that you sent or transmitted a signal to Juno. The engineers are collectively going to figure out what this was. What it amounts to is a lot of power going up through the atmosphere. They're actually hoping that the ionosphere is, you know, a bad propagation for 10 meters. They're hoping for a very bad propagation. The reason why is bad propagation. Chances are a lot of stuff is not hitting the ionosphere and reflecting back. That means it's going out into space. And they have a better chance of having the Juno spacecraft copy this high signal in CW at a very slow pace. I mean, it's down to like 1/25th per character or something. Some bizarre speed, to give an idea, the whole word of high takes 30. It takes 10 minutes. So, any questions, Dick? I got all kinds of information on this project that they're looking to get people to do. This is WS2N.
Yeah, boy, I've got two big questions for you. I'm going to hit you only with the first one first, and that is, what is the website I can go to find out about the timing of Juno that's going to do this gravity assist flyby of the Earth? I think you said this coming Wednesday. And if I go to a particular website, I get the individual pieces of information. You may have said it, and I didn't catch it, Paul. So give me that website first. And it said that because of the what's going on with Congress, where an awful lot of things are not being funded, boy, do I have a comment on that. I'll give it to you on the next transmission. Over to you first, Paul. WS2N, KQLIW.
Okay, Dick, I tried to rush through this. I know we don't have that much time. So, two websites. I'll give you the other one. The first website that had all the information, now they have the timer is left on this NASA site, and then I'll give you the other one, which I like better. But, you know, if they come to an agreement, I guess this will come back to life. It's www.jpl, that's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, .nasa.gov /HI Juno, J-U-N-O. So it's www.jpl.nasa.gov /HIJUNO. Now that one is, you know, you'll see the countdown clock, and you know, they'll have the deal where you got to push the button and all, but there's no explanations left on that, where you can get all this information. Plus, I got a little bit more I have to give you. About the story is, this is a better one. You go to, this is called missionsjuno.swri.edu. This is a real good one. This will have everything that I'm telling you here, plus more. I'll give it to you again. It's missionsjuno@swri.edu. Now I'll give it to you slowly. missionsjuno.swri.edu. I tried on a couple of different computers, so they'll come up. They have a system on transmitting, depending on your call letter, the last letter of your call letter, for instance, mine is N, I would be transmitting on a different frequency than you, Dick, you know, yours W. So, everything is done on 10 meters between 28 and 28.45. There's one segment in the middle because they have a bandpass. It's centered in the middle of this 10-meter band, and they're picking up before and after. So, it's actually between 28.1. I had the exact numbers here before. Stand by one.
Dick, I have a quick announcement when you're ready.
Roger.
Okay, it's between 28.1 and 28.45, and then the other part of the band is a little bit higher up, 28.55 to 28.999. Now everybody's going to say, okay, that's going into the phone portion of the band, and anything above 28.3. Well, CW is actually legal all throughout the whole band. So no problem there. Of course, they tell you if there's anybody on there, you can't transmit. Make sure the frequency is clear. Make sure you ID before and after. If you're going to go 10 minutes, do it again every 10 minutes to keep it legal. And, for instance, they have different letters. Every letter of the alphabet. but depending how your call letter ends, you would transmit on that frequency. So, for instance, if your call letter ended in the letter A, alpha, you would be transmitting on 28001. Further down the line, give you an idea, if it ends in H, it would be 28.109. Midi, I would be the letter N, 28234. So that's where I would be transmitting. Now, if you can't transmit there for whatever reason, somebody else is there, your radio doesn't work too good, mine's in bad shape, I'm going to have to go down somewhere else. You can go anywhere you want, but that's what they're doing, trying to keep it separated a little bit. That's roughly the idea. You can get further information, unless you have questions now, Dick. Back to that, WS2N.
KC2LR.
KC2LR, I'm going to pick you up right after John's comment. KC2WGB, go right ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, little announcement on the chat room. There's a note here. The Long Island Linux User Group is having a meeting on Tuesday. Anybody, this is for newbies, for newcomers to Linux. If anybody's interested, I'll give you the website. It's www.LILUG, the Long Island Users Group, Linux Users Group. And the meeting is scheduled. They don't give me a time, but it's for Tuesday. So anybody who's interested, contact that website. All the information is there. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
You didn't give us the extension. www.LILUG, is it .org? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, I'm sorry, yes, .org.
Yeah, my son Christopher was one of the officials of LILUG, and maybe he's interested in going to that meeting. Okay, K2, I think it was LR, I may have dropped one of the letters. Correct me on your call letters and your name. I'll go right ahead with your information. K2LR, ? K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. This is AC2LR. My name is Kay. And I wanted to just add, on the Southwest Research Institute website, the missionjuno.swri.com, you can just go to missionjuno.com and it will redirect you there. And I had actually had a question about what it would do to the radio if you're holding down a straight key for 30 seconds and then for 2.5 hours, it's going to be about 60 repeats of that 30-second signal. So I called the engineers who were running the program, and they helped me through it. They said, you know, just make sure that your antenna is resonant. And I also called ICOM. I'm using an ICOM Pro 756. It's going to drop for a second. And ICOM gave me the go-ahead tech support. But the other thing I just wanted to add to the comments is that they told me when you enter your call sign at the beginning of the signal, do it after the timer hits zero. So you're going to watch the timer on the website, and it's going to count down 3, 2, 1, 0. Then you enter your call sign, and then you start the 30-second signal. And so the first signal might be 29 seconds and not 30, but that's okay. And that's it. Back to the net.
Very good information, Kay. Thank you for that. Most rigs nowadays in the CW mode are essentially protected from key down continuous operation and not overheating, as long as you've got a reasonable amount of airflow for the heat sink fins on the back of the rig. If you've got the rig packed in some kind of a little cubby hole where there's not much airflow, you could get into a problem. And many of the rigs also have a thermal protect circuit that when it becomes above a certain temperature, it either turns on a fan or lowers the amount of drive power. Most of these rigs are pretty good on self-protecting. So all of this will work much, much better if you're using an antenna tuner and a well-tuned antenna and or well-tuned antenna so that the transmitter is seeing a nearly pure 50-ohm load with a very low standing wave ratio. Let me drop. Most rigs, when they're adjusted correctly and designed correctly to feed a 50-ohm load antenna, if you give them an antenna with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, for instance, then the reflected power from the antenna, which is something around 9% of the power is going to be reflected, that coming back to the transmitter creates, you could say, 9% extra heating, and it starts pushing the transmitter above limitation. So many rig, when it starts seeing a higher VISWR, will go into a self-protect mode where it starts cutting itself back. So even if at worst your rig doesn't have enough self-protect, even if at worst you've got a high enough VISWR, even if at worst you blow the final stage, as long as you bring it to a person who is pretty skilled at fixing things, the final transistor on most of these rigs is not that expensive. Replacing it's not a big deal, so I wouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep over that. So try to make your antenna have a low VISWR, properly tuned antenna tuner if need be, and then just go right ahead and do this as I see it. A good thing to do. Anybody have further comments before I hit the poll with my crazy question? Give me a call, let us right now, K2RIW.
K2RIW.
What a comment.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, Jay first and then Dennis in that order. AC2LR, K2RIW, go ahead, K.
Thank you, AC2LR. One other thing one of the engineers told me is they have I cannot remember the call frequency, but they're going to have an ongoing special event station, and if you go on their QRZ webpage, there, go under the call sign A0IO. That's Alpha Zero India Oscar. I forgot what O stands for. But anyway, and then you can find out where the ongoing mission broadcast will be. Milligan's going to be talking about it for the next couple of days on that on frequency. I forget what. Okay, back to you next.
Good to know information. Kay, when I go to QRZ.com and type in AC2LR, I see you operating equipment that looks like it's on a table, and alongside of the table is a very large wheel. I'm kind of curious, what was that? If I read your words, maybe it'll explain it to me, but tell us what that is, Jay. Kay, go ahead.
That is a portable rig that I have no credit for at all. Someone else made that up. And it's a hand-turn generator. And inside, I cannot remember what size battery that was, but it was so masterfully made. This guy, Mike, I cannot remember his call sign. Sorry. he bought a fishing tackle box, and he put the battery inside, and he rigged it to the wheel. So someone just stands there and turns the wheel on the outside of the tackle box while someone else is using the radio. And then we take turns, and it's pretty fun. And then we just, we put up a big 31-foot pole and connected an antenna to it. We do portable in the park every Sunday if it's nice out.
Unusual, okay. I've heard of Armstrong rotation, where you use your muscle power to turn a mast that has an antenna on the top, and you aim the antenna in different directions. You've got Armstrong power generation. Does your right arm get stronger as you use that wheel to pump up the batteries? Is that what's going on here, Kay? Go ahead.
AC2LR. Absolutely. It's tiring. I keep asking if we can bring a bicycle so we can use other limbs. You do have to switch hands after a while. But there's usually, maybe 10 or 15 people come. So we have a couple of different radios set up on different picnic tables. But if three or four people are at that table with that hand crank generator, then we just all take turns and nobody gets tired.
Well done. Very crafty engineering. That's a very green thing to do. And you're challenging the hell out of Dennis, who is our green maven here. So by muscle power, they're generating electricity, Dennis. Doesn't have to be by photovoltaics. NY2HF, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Dick, I can't beat that one. I don't have a wheel that I can spin and generate. I have batteries and photovoltaics. But that's really a great idea. I just wanted to make a technical point. When it gets laid into the TechNet, I usually go on to EchoLink and I listen. And I bring it to bed and I listen to, as much as I can stay up for. But tonight, away, I got upstairs, and what's happening on Echolink is that it's breaking in and out, and you can't really get the conversations that are going on. So I don't know if it's maybe underpowered, and so it's not holding it, but I had to come back to the shack so that I could listen to the remainder. Back to that.
You wanted to make a comment about the government funding.
Yeah, not to worry. One other possible solution for you, Dennis, is if you have the right kind of antenna on the roof, maybe a Yagi, aimed at whichever repeater you want to listen to, and in your case, 975, 375 is probably the best. I'd like to believe you can pick up enough signal that if that cable came into your bedroom and plugged into your handy talkie, you'd be able to hear that repeater. That's a possible approach, similar to back in December when I was in the hospital in Huntington for 3 days. I had my son bring me pieces of RG58 cable. I made a monopole antenna by stripping it back the insulation just right, taping it against the shade on the wall, and I was managed to pick up enough signal to be able to hear what was going on with the TechNet that night, as I remember. I think I was there on a Sunday. I'm not sure now. But so I think there's a possibility that you could have a backup system other than Echolink. Eric is making quite a few additions to the RF linking and computer improvements of the system, so some of those details, we'll bring it to his attention. They're eventually going to go away, and thank you for telling us. Anything else you want to add to this one, Dennis? NY2HF, K2LIW?
Yes, thank you, Dick. The only reason I mentioned it, you're right, I can run a wire into the bedroom. That's not a problem. But for all the people who rely on Echolink to listen in from all over the world, they're not getting it. You know, if what's happening to mine is happening to theirs, they're losing all this valuable session, you know, with you and Paul and John. So that was my point. I can circumvent it, but somebody who relies just primarily on Echolink may not be able to.
Yeah, that's good to know, Dennis, and thank you. And for those people who got dropped out, it's too bad because Wes, John, I, and Paul were teaching everybody how to become millionaires right away, and we'll have to get the information somewhere else. Joke on that one. Paul, I've got this crazy question for you, and let me give you a little bit of a history. There's a particular company I worked for 11 years, every single day, as a consultant. Unusual, of course. Nobody hires a consultant for that length of time. Well, I happen to have this specific skill called antenna design and a very exotic kind of antennas with standing wave ratio of below 1.05 to 1 across the whole frequency region. That was the requirement for all the antennas that they needed. The number of people on planet Earth that had the skill to do that, I think, is very small. As such, they kept hiring me. Okay. Even though they were exceeding their rules to do it, if you know what I mean. Okay. One of the consultants I was working with, who was working side by side with me, recognized the fact that some kind of a mix-up was occurring with the scheduling department, marketing department, bills paid. One of the departments was having problems with the IRS, with the continuous service of these consultants, were they employees or were they contract labor. And so in order to bring it to a head, that accounting department forced the pay to cease in order to take the department that was hiring the person to bring it to a head and solve the problem. Okay. The other consultant, when he found that he was no longer getting any pay, immediately stopped showing up. I knew I was having fun what I was doing. I knew that they needed what I was doing fast enough. I kept right on working, even though the flow of dollars stopped. I kept right on working. And that went on for something like 3 weeks. Various people knew that I'm working on my own nickel, free of charge, and they said, what's wrong with this guy? And the answer is, I have faith in this company. I know they're going to straighten it out. They have ethics. They will eventually be paying me. If they don't, I'll survive. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I show up when I want to. I leave when I want to. The people I work with ask me what would I like to work on. They would make sure that I worked on that to keep me happy. So it was a good relationship, and I kept right on working. Let me drop. Okay, when you get something like the Lincoln Memorial or the Statue of Liberty, these are very important structures in the United States as far as our reputation, our image, and whatever. If some of those individuals who are not being paid during this interruption period decided to keep right on working and open up the site, what law would they be violating? Is there somebody standing at the gate with a gun saying, even though you're an employee, I'm not going to let you in? If you're the normal employee that does the job and you decide to, for the time being, work on your nickel, is somebody going to stop you from doing it? And there are proposals right now saying that these people on furlough are going to get back pay. Are they going to be paid for the days they weren't there? That's kind of crazy. So if an enthusiastic individual with the right attitude wanted to keep right on working, even though for the time being he's not getting paid, what's going to stop him from doing that? I'm going to pass it over to you first, Paul, and then anybody else who has real legal knowledge can answer this one for us. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. The first guy to worry about is insurance problems. You get hurt on the job, you could. I know, it's probably a very safe thing, but you take a fall down the stairs or something. What are you doing there? Who's going to pay for the compensation? These are problems that, that could come up. You'd be rolling the dice. If you're a contractor, an independent contractor or not, you have to watch out for that. You can find out what it is if you go down and collect unemployment and they tell you can't get it, you're an independent contractor, then you can say, well, where's my money? You can get into all kinds of problems. As far as a lot of the jobs, if they're shutting an area down, now they're shutting something down, they're not going to do away with their security. And if they say that this building is shut, well, you're not coming in. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Okay, so insurance makes it kind of complicated. If I'm really enthusiastic and willing to sign a release saying that I'm not going to blame anybody if I do something dumb and I injure myself during this period of time, but I want to keep working because I think this national monument should be open to the people who have spent their money, made the schedule 6 months ago, and they and their family are going to have this reunion at the Mount Rushmore Memorial, and we want to follow through on it, and I want to let those people have the ability, therefore even without pay, I'm going to continue to work as a park ranger at that site. If I'm willing to sign that release, is somebody going to stop me from doing that? Have we gotten down to that much legalistic mumbo jumbo? Anybody with any opinions on this? Give me your call letters right now. I've been through something similar. K2LIW in the TechNet.
BGC would comment.
I got a comment on that, Dick.
Okay, John and Dennis in that area, in that order. John first, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, if the government closes a site and an individual who does work for the government decides that even though he was furloughed, opens the site and a tourist gets hurt, or, a visitor, who does that liability fall on? There you go. Can't be done. My view. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, you bring up a nasty situation. However, if the company supplying the insurance didn't have a specific contract addressing the so-called furlough, where the insurance premiums are going to continue to flow, and I think they are, I suspect that there's situations where there will be insurance for the visitors.
Government self-insured, Dick.
Oh, well. So it's not an independent contractor for the insurance. Oh, well. Let's see what Dennis has got to say on this. Dennis, make sure you wait for the three beeps before you talk. NY2HF, K2LIW in the TechNet.
The tourists, they haven't signed that waiver. you know, it has come down to insurance. I mean, everybody's taking trampolines out of their backyards and, you know, all sorts of stuff. You know, the liability is just too great. Matter of fact, if you got a trampoline, most times they tell you, you know, if you declare it, they'll cancel your insurance. It's that serious. Back to that.
I see the problem. Oh, well. And so I, as an independent contractor, had to supply my own medical insurance. But when it comes to the liability insurance for me being injured while I'm in the building, if I fell down a flight of stairs, would I get some kind of remuneration from the insurance company of the company that I was contracting for? Interesting question. I didn't even worry about those details. I didn't advertise the fact that I wasn't being paid and I was continuing to work. I just quietly kept right on working and waited for the accounting department or whatever it was department to figure it all out, and they eventually did. And I eventually got paid. I knew I would. And if I didn't, I would survive. I had done well enough before then and after then that I wouldn't have died if that particular interrupted period I didn't get paid, if you know what I mean. Okay. I think there was another, that was the main question I was going to ask Paul. How did you first find out about this HI system with the Juno? I guess by reading those particular websites. And that's question number one. And question number two, I'm reasonably sure now that everybody is sure that Voyager is well outside of the solar system and the area where the solar wind goes out to. I think they have passed through that threshold where the solar wind doesn't go there anymore, and the dominant thing that Voyager is now seeing is galactic wind, which comes in at some other direction, at some other velocity, and some other E-field, if you know what I mean. So that chunk of electronics, 17 hours one way at the speed of light to talk to it, another 17 hours for the signal to come back. Man, that is way out there. And for the people who worry, let me drop...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And for the people who worry about a radio signal or any electromagnetic signal going a certain distance and getting tired and slowing down and getting weaker, other than the inverse square law, there is no other weakening mechanism in free space per se. And when it comes to a 10 meter signal, 28 megacycles, reflecting off the ionosphere, we call it reflection. At a grazing angle that you aim on that signal near the horizon, it hits the ionosphere at a very low angle, and with a certain amount of ionospheric ionization, you get a pretty good reflection, damn good reflection. But if you feed the signal straight up through that ionosphere, simplistically thinking, you would think it would act like a sheet of metal and the signal doesn't go through. You can never stop any signal from any direction. You can attenuate it. In that 100 dB tempest-proof screen room at Edwards Air Force Base, the anechoic facility, what was it called now? I've forgotten the name of the guy. Anyhow, the Benny Field anechoic facility, in that extremely carefully constructed screen room, radio signals went in and radio signals came out. They were 110 dB down, but they still went there. That ionosphere, let me drop. No way in the world is that ionosphere a perfect shield. It's going to weaken the signal. There's still going to be some 10-meter signal going through the ionosphere. And with enough smart, you can calculate how much. So there's still something for the Juno spacecraft to see as I see it. Either of those subjects, you want to give us some more information, go right ahead, call WS2N with the Space Report, K2LAW in the TechNav.
Okay, Dick, the first question was, how did I hear about it? It was one of those emails, you know, the ARRO sends them all the email, one week after the other, and one of them, you know, you go through all the different topics, have this topic, and then you go to the website, and one thing leads to another, and you go to another website, and then you find the better ones of the two, and I had printed it out, and I'm glad I did, because then I went back to it a couple of days ago. It was gone. Here's this NASA warning that they're closed. So I had all my papers that I had printed. So I'm able to bring it up on the net. But the one website I did find tonight does have a lot of the same information that I printed out. And Juno is halfway to where it's really got to go, even though it's passing on Wednesday. It'll be going into orbit around Jupiter in 2016. It's roughly a one-year mission. It'll orbit the planet about 33 times, in an orbital, polar orbital fashion. Very low, it'll come very low to the surface and then go far out past Callisto. And in doing that, they avoid radiation problems. They keep it to a minimum, although the electronics are in a titanium one-inch thick box type of thing. They're using a dipole for this antenna that we're going to be transmitting to. It's a 2.8-meter dipole set at 120 degrees. So it's not straight out, but it's coming off from the center. And what else can we talk about it? It's got a lot of attenuators on it because when it goes through the atmosphere of Jupiter, it's going to pick up a lot of radio signal. It's going to, of course, it's not going to have intelligent modulation behind it, but it will pick up radio signals coming from Jupiter as well as the plasma. It's a wave detector. It's going to detect radio plasma waves coming off the planet. And that's what they want to use it for. There you go, Dick. It's a rough idea of what's going on. It's a $700 million project. After the 1 year, they're going to deorbit it and burn up in the Jupiter atmosphere. They don't want to contaminate any of the take a chance of contaminating the other moons. It hasn't been treated for microorganisms, hasn't gone through that process. Back to you, Dick.
A fun project. Sorry to hear that IRLP or the Echolink was working poorly tonight. I could tell by the fact that I'm continuously monitoring the 146.85 output of this machine that it was continuously there, and that's the main thing that Mike Perry reports, KC2NJI. So therefore, you'll still be able to hear all of the SickNet on that recording by going to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And it takes about a week or so for the recording to appear on that website. We're down to about 1 or 2 minutes before we're going to be ending. This was TechNet number 1,470 of the TechNets that began way back in September of 1982, 31 and a fraction years ago. We think we're going to be back next week, as long as we all stay healthy. There's certainly enough interest in this subject. As I said, arguably ham radio. Let me drop a quick. I know of very few avocations, hobbies, or whatever that you can get into that is potentially more educational than ham radio. You're talking to other interested people, curious people, who have studied for a radio license. The FCC issued that license to them. That starts you off with a common denominator, even though your background may be very different. Looks like we're being cut off. Bye-bye, you all. We'll see you next week. K2RIW clear. Be kind to each other, and bye-bye for now. John, if you're still there?
Hi, Dick, and 2MB.
Dick, thank everybody for joining in on the net, and we'll meet again next week. Willem and Abel will be here, KC2WGB.
Hey, Barry, N2 Moonbounce, who's done a lot of Moonbounce. Dead wrong on some of the things I said about Moonbounce and the philosophy and the pleasure you get back out of it after making a big investment? N2 Moonbounce, Q2RAW.
B3ZZ, so?
V3ZZ, Q2RAW. Go ahead, Scott.
Well,
good evening to all. I'll let you know the IRLP link to 9126 reflector was fine throughout the net. There were no technical issues. The audio stream was